Good afternoon, everybody. Can we come to order, please? Thank you. Yes, Levina, we're coming to order today. Welcome back from whatever you were doing before this. Glad to have you here. This is session 254. The title is Knowing When to Say Goodbye, Mormonism and Medical Decision-Making at the End of Life. Our speaker is Samuel Brown, M.D., is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Please do not go up to him later and tell him about what aches you have in your side. I monopolize that time with him later on. He's a fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine, University of Utah, researcher in...
Jeff, speak directly into the microphone.
Researcher in... There we go. Thank you. Researcher in epidemiology and statistical predictions of lifespan in people with critical illnesses, etc., and so on. The respondent is Richard Sherlock. Are you here yet, Richard Sherlock? There he is. He is a PhD professor of philosophy and ethics at Utah State University. I am going to talk for one more minute because we're waiting for a cable to arrive so that he can hook up his computer. A few ground rules which you're all familiar with, and I hope that you abide by them. If you have cell phones, please turn them off. And always remember that a recording of this talk will be available later on today. We will have a question and answer series later on. We are going to ask you, if you're going to make a comment or a question, to make sure you step up to the microphone so that it's caught on the CD. Now, do you want to say a few words in introduction? We can do that.
Sure.
Okay.
This is a bit of a departure from me. Some of you do know me from the Mormon studies environment.
Is the microphone, Sam?
Is it on?
Is this on?
There we go.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry. A fair number of you may know me from the Mormon studies environment, where I do a variety of projects in cultural history. Those tend to be the traditional humanities academic. You write a paper, you give a sermon at a lectern. But today I decided to go a little bit closer to my actual paid professional specialty, and doctors give talks with slides. We don't use prepared talks, and unfortunately they said they had everything set up for us to do the slides, but they don't yet. So I think what we should do is exploit this opportunity to... This is a bit of an experiment for me. I haven't talked to the audiences about this before, and I overwrote the slides so that if there's a particular area that's of particular interest, we can focus on it. So I don't know if you can see this, but the topics that we can talk about... You guys have glasses, some of you. I'm going to read these. And... we can emphasize any of these particular topics, or we can skip over particular topics. The area that I do in cultural history is the history of death culture. I was going to mention very briefly. I can give a bit of a history of heroic life support technologies. I can do something on the mechanics and the outcomes of heroic life support technologies. Okay. Well, that's one voice. Being a little bit on the left, I do recommend hearing from all voices, but we'll bracket that for a minute. An area of special interest for me is predicting the future at the deathbed. Prognosis is the fancy word, but to what extent we can figure out who is going to die and when. Ethical aspects of end-of-life care. Official LDS policy pronouncements on end-of-life care. And then... something that Dr. Sherlock was particularly interested in is comparative end-of-life policy and the ethics of uncertainty. That's situating Mormon approaches within other approaches, particularly Catholicism and Judaism, and also talking a little bit about the ethics of uncertainty. How do you make ethical decisions with less than adequate information?
Can you stop that icon from going around the screen?
I wanted to have somebody have a seizure so that I could talk about it. When they said, is there a doctor in the house?
Oh, good. There's two people.
Oh, good grief.
So the gentleman with the cable appears to disappear. my sense from the most vocal people here at Stage Left is that they're interested in a little bit about the mechanics and outcomes of heroic life support, predicting what's going to happen, what the church has said, and what the ethics are. That's the core that people are interested in. Okay, fair enough. Let's try an experiment, and there you end up. I start with a rather glib slide. This is a picture. If you search for rapture on Google Images, this will come up. It's one apparently possibly future liberal or gay or otherwise odd gentleman in a red shirt, and one apparently not in a yellow shirt being lifted up to the clouds. But to start the talk, I wanted to say that we forget this, but in point of fact, mortality in humans approaches 100%. This is my joke, that there's a rapture exception, which rarely applies. The timing of death is occasionally modifiable. The quality of death, and what we mean by that, probably, is the life experience during the period immediately preceding death. That is sometimes modifiable. And to be honest, in the last three decades, the borderlands between life and death have become much less distinct than they were previously. Briefly on the history, this is Hans Baldung's picture of a knight, the maid, and then death. Death is the cheetah trying to tear the dress of the young woman. I will leave to those who are interested a reading of some of my cultural history on this. Needless to say, it's a fascinating topic, underappreciated by many of us. Broader history, I would just say that before the Civil War, people died at home. Over the 50 to 80 years after the Civil War, they began to die in the hospital. In the last 50 to 60 years, they began to die in the intensive care unit. And since about the 60s, there's been a slowly mounting movement to go back home, to focus on dying outside of heroic, intensive, technological medicine. Development of intensive care, very briefly, probably as we understand it, didn't exist somewhere between 1950 and 1975. The part that supports the lungs developed out of the polio epidemics. These have the iron lungs. And during a Copenhagen epidemic in, I think, 1953, one of the anesthesiologists said, they're all dying in the iron lungs. What if we stick them up, attach them to the surgical ventilator machine, and see what happens? And they began to survive, and thus began the medical intensive care era. The rest of it, I think, given your interests, is not as exciting. This intro slide I call the mechanics of biomedicine, near-death electronics. This is actually this is West's Death on a Pale Horse, a famous thing. And the reason I included it is that his scepter glows bright as if it's got electronic light bulbs on it. Wanted to go over a little bit some of these biomedical therapies that are available for people at the end of life. CPR, also called the code. You watch the TV, right? This is the code. Anybody have a sense for what the codes mean? It turns out that codes were color-coded. And there's code red means fire. Code gray in different facilities means there's a psychotic individual on the loose.
I am a psychotic individual.
Code brown is one used by the nurses to describe fecal incontinence of large volumes. I kid you not.
Why are you talking to me when you talk about fecal incontinence?
Code pink means somebody believes a baby has been stolen, which it turns out is as likely as Satan worship, i.e. doesn't happen, but we talk about it an awful lot. And then there's code blue. You know why it's called code blue? Because your lips turn blue. Yeah, we call that cyanosis. But that's what it evolved from. People were afraid to say, alert, we believe a patient has died. So they used these code words. Yeah, code orange in some facilities is now being used as a bioterror warning. Anybody have a sense about what's going on with this?
Sometimes you have to restart the computer when you get it plugged in.
No, this one's always worked just fine before.
It's not the computer.
The gray sounded off after it sound.
No, it should be sort of
better. Yeah. Oh, that's right. It's left up. Where's this select? There we go.
Go back together so we can sing it for Romans.
Okay, so this is Death on a Pale Horse, Ben West. These are these electronic light bulbs.
Lower the lights.
Do we have the lights? Can we get the lights on?
I'll be in the back. I don't know where they are.
Somebody in the back. I'm going to try to get the lights on. Okay, so cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. Docs call it ACLS for advanced cardiac life support. These are a variety of Google image options. The electric eel, little fish. I'm not allowed to play with electricity, but mum won't mind me playing with you. These are chest compressions. This is the electricity. And those are the mannequins that were trained to perform CPR on. CPR essentially is the rhythmic movement of the chest, which forces blood to flow. And then because the heart valves open and then snap shut when flow begins to go backwards, you're able to circulate blood through the body. It's not actually pumping the heart per se. It's exploiting the valves. Every once in a while, we will perform it with an open chest. In that setting, we are, in fact, massaging the heart. But by and large, if you push the breastbone in 2 inches, you'll be able to move blood through the chest. You can also blow air into the lungs, but in fact, chest movement generally provides adequate air. And the most recent guidelines are if you find someone that you think you need to perform a CPR on, you don't need to do mouth-to-mouth. You blow out only 15% oxygen. God gives them 21%. And it turns out that the movement of the chest moves blood and air simultaneously.
I've often wondered when you do CPR that you're actually blowing expanded air into another person's body. I've often wondered why that isn't harmful.
Well, it turns out that 15 to 60% oxygen is basically the equivalent of living in Park City. People live in Park City, so it's fine. You expel about 15% oxygen.
So they can survive in Park City.
Okay. There are other factors that predict survival in Park City. But in terms of your oxygen supply, you're absolutely correct.
A good ski pass doesn't hurt you.
What's that?
I say having a good ski pass doesn't hurt you.
Yes. Although when you're dead, you can't ski.
Please repeat your question so it gets
hard
to be.
Sure. In fact, with CPR, the primary thing you're doing is trying to prevent brain damage until you can defibrillate the heart. That's generally speaking, that's the one therapy that will actually save the person's life. CPR is just to prevent them from being brain damaged in the event that you're able to bring them back. And that reboots the heart. Outcomes of CPR. This is something I talk about with patients at cancer hospitals, not infrequently. The outcome of CPR, if you have metastatic cancer, it's been measured many times, is zero. Thousands of patients say survival to hospital discharge is zero if you've got cancer that's spread and your heart stops. Unwitnessed cardiac arrest, less than 1 in 25 patients will survive to return home. They may survive in an ICU for a period of time. They may even wake up slightly before they pass again, generally within 30 to 40 days at the outside. If we see you slump over, that's from a regular heart attack. If we can defibrillate within 3 to 5 minutes, you have about a half likelihood that you'll survive. If it's delayed to about 10 minutes, it drops off to about 1.25. And if it's delayed for more than 15 minutes, survival is extremely uncommon. But I play one on TV. published in the Preeminent Medical Journal is a special article, Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation on Television, Miracles and Misinformation. Turns out these docs watched Chicago Hope, ER, Rescue 911. This is how many TV episodes they watched. This is how often CPR was performed. And this is how often patients survived from CPR. You can see that on Rescue 911, if you're lucky enough to be a TV star, 100% of you will survive. But even Chicago Hope, the darker, windy city, well over half survive, which is just not accurate based on real medical data. These authors hypothesize that this is the reason that Americans believe that CPR is going to end well for them. Not so fast. Flanders, not Ned, but the county or society he was named for, retorted. They watched Flemish television, and they challenged directly the paper I just showed you. They say, people who watch a lot of medical fiction, that's the name for these shows, overestimate how well CPR is going to work. So they studied a popular Flemish medical drama. I don't speak Flemish. Spode, sped, I'm not sure anybody knows. Welcome to correct me. And what's interesting is that they were a bit closer to reality in terms of what they depicted. 1 in 5 only of patients receiving CPR survived. What's interesting, though, is that people in Flanders still believe that they would survive if CPR were performed on them. Talk a little bit about mechanical ventilation of lung life support. These are the original iron lungs that were used to treat polio. And in fact, there are still iron lungs in use. The company that makes them is in danger of bankruptcy. They're not that popular, even at parties. And these are the traditional ventilators that we tend to use in the ICU. The mechanics of a ventilator is basically an elaborate bellows system that brings in oxygen primarily, but also air, and then blows off carbon dioxide. And then we say sophisticated computer, but frankly, the computer is no more sophisticated than a desktop PC within the last 2 years. The software is sophisticated, but the computer itself isn't that complicated. And then you put a big plastic tube in the windpipe. You blow in oxygen and air, and you blow out carbon dioxide. Outcomes of mechanical ventilation are very difficult. This is not like CPR, where it's generally pretty dismal outcomes. Short term, you just don't know until you've given some time. Once you've been ventilated for about a week, it depends on the disease, maybe 1 in 10, at most 1 in 3, will eventually be liberated from the ventilator, will eventually be able to breathe on their own. Recovery in survivors is generally very slow. It's a frustrating process for people to come off the ventilator. And even in 6 or 12 months afterwards, they continue to have complaints of shortness of breath and weakness and a lack of what we call exertional capacity or ability to get their heart up and do some work. Vasopressors are another therapy that I commonly administer. Basically, it's adrenaline. There are modifications, but fundamentally, it's injecting adrenaline into the veins. We use it primarily to treat shock, which is low blood pressure that's potentially fatal. In general, shock portends something in the range of 30 to 80% mortality a month after it begins. It's a pretty sick place to be. Usually, to give the adrenaline in order to avoid compromising arms or legs, we'll place a special sterile catheter in the jugular vein or under the clavicle. And that allows us, it gets it to within about 3 inches of the heart. We administer the medication through there. Kidney replacement is another heroic medical therapy, particularly for patients that are very sick. That's dialysis that you've heard about. It basically uses an osmosis membrane and high flows of blood through a machine to eliminate waste products from the blood. You get about double the risk of death if you're sick enough to be in ICU and then your kidneys fail. So if you started out with 40% chance of dying, then developing kidney failure pushes you, unfortunately, up to 80%. Now, in everybody, including those who just have diabetes and eventually the kidneys fail, about only half of them will be alive 5 years after it's initiated. And the patients who started in the ICU, many fewer will actually survive. Artificial alimentation, that's providing nutrition to people who can't eat in normal ways. Now, we talk about tube feeds, but they're just disgusting-tasting shakes. You can do IV nutrition, which is highly sterilized food into the veins. And you can also just do fluids and sugars. There are lots of different kinds of individuals that will receive artificial alimentation. At some level, breastfeeding, when we think of it as natural, is alimentation provided to a patient that's unable to acquire it on her own. There are also profoundly disabled babies who will never be able to feed themselves. There are adults who can't keep their foodstuffs out of their lungs as they attempt to swallow drops into the windpipe instead of into the stomach. Brain-injured adults and adults with dysfunctional throats, such as survivors of cancers of the head and neck, who are never able to swallow normally. There's a wide range of individuals that might consider artificial nutrition. But one thing that's interesting in the debates about artificial nutrition, apropos Terry Schiavo's recent sad passage, is some interesting data that's provided by Social Conflict in Ireland. The Maze prison hunger strikes some of you were around for in the 1980s. These were basically healthy, I don't know what you want to call them, they're healthy young people who for political, religious, social, legal reasons were imprisoned as part of the Irish revolt. And they said, fine, I'm not going to eat, you will have executed me. The earliest death of these basically healthy individuals happened in 46 days. They drank water, they ate no food. The longest was actually 73 days. And there were people who fasted to 70 days who their families finally talked them back. Their friends were dying, and had died, and they said, fair enough, I will eat again. Those people actually survived. Now, for patients who are not 26-year-old members of the IRA, who are pretty healthy physically, somewhere in the range of 10 to 20 days is the amount of time it takes for a body to pass as a result of no nutrition. There have been debates about the sensation associated with terminal starvation. For centuries, it's been known that the hunger pains actually tend to recede after 2 to 4 days. This was known back from medieval periods when ecstasies were induced by fasting among a variety of Catholic mystics. And in pre-World War I America, there are some scientists in Chicago who actually wrote this long treatise that I've read where they identified themselves by just the first initial of their last names, Mr. L and Dr. D. They starved themselves for 5 days and then took meticulous diaries of all the sensations they were having and stuck a tube through their nose that sat in their stomachs and measured when the stomach contracts. They kept these careful diaries through it. They said that at about 2 or 3 days, they were no longer hungry, but they felt like crap. They were kind of depressed. They were a little bit lethargic. And interestingly, though, by day 4, they actually had relatively lost interest in food. It just wasn't as much of a big deal for them. It just felt kind of weak. So the notion of painful starving to death is complicated. Most literature suggests, particularly in patients that were not healthy beforehand, but after a couple of days, you're just not hungry anymore, and you're just kind of tired. It doesn't have the huge effect that we sometimes think it does. Now let's talk about prognostication in medicine. Sorry. Yeah, prophesying upon the bones. You know, as I was writing this talk, I thought, wow, we use Apache SOFA and SAPS, our the equations that we use to predict outcome. So we got this racist-sounding Apache, right? The Indians are the specters of death. We got a Freudian sofa, and then we got SAPs. Right? We have not thought carefully about how to construct our equations. Basically, though, this set of equations have allowed us to, for us, a reasonable degree of certainty to predict who's going to live and who's going to die when they show up to the hospital sick. Now, the trick, though, is that most of them top out around 80 to 90% certainty. It's very rare that we can say there is 100% certainty that a given patient will die if full medical therapy is provided. Some interesting literature about, well, does the doctrine of any of these fancy statistical things, right? The American refrain is, I am not a number. And they actually looked at ICU physicians, their predictions, and then what actually happened. If the ICU physician thought you had a 90% chance of dying, you actually probably only had an 80% chance of dying. Does that matter? Maybe not. they thought you had a 10 to 40% chance of surviving. 80% of them survived. And if they thought that you had a high likelihood of survival, more than half, most people survived. The nurses were substantially less sanguine. If they said you were pretty much guaranteed to die, only half actually did die. You had some senior critical care physicians in the United States. This was Canadian doctors. There are several studies, and it showed that at the degrees where people were really very sick, 80 to 100% chance of death, the physicians outperformed the equations and were generally right. If you had less than an 80% chance of dying, the physicians were likely to overestimate your risks of death. The physicians overall were about as good as Apache, and this is just a reminder that in a couple of studies, in the U.S. at least, people in my specialty were better than the equations that predicted it. Let me look real quick. We got 5 minutes. Let me just see what we want to look at here. Let's move on. We can talk about this at a later point. In terms of the Latter-day Saint principles and practices, right, we're interested in the LDS, hence the Sunstone Symposium. Fundamentally, we believe the afterlife is probably a better place. No single act of deathbed repentance will change this outcome. Faith healings, we call them personal blessings, invite providential readings of the outcome. Some of you may not know that we actually practiced dedication of the sick unto death from about 1846 till it was canceled in 1922. As I was mulling over this talk, the Ensign published a story by a 70 that actually, in complimentary terms, talked about the practice of dedicating unto death. So we may be seeing a resurgence. There are some cultural strands in Mormonism. There's transhumanism. There are the health fadists and the Word of Wisdom extremists. The kind of old West pragmatists that I've met since moving here 2 years ago, they tend to live in Idaho, Wyoming, and Nevada now. They're fairly, you know, if it's my time, it's my time. Don't mess around with me a lot. I want to die with my boots on. There's the modern American culture of denial, fear of lost salvation, and then the possibility of posthumous rehabilitation, given some of our perfectionist impulses. There is a political overlay. I won't talk about it much. Let's look at the LDS pronouncements quickly. There is a church policy. Showed up, I think, sometime in the 1980s. Clearly there by 99. Wasn't there in 76. Euthanasia is when you put somebody to death, includes physician-assisted suicide, violates the commandments of God. A milder statement here, when severe illness strikes, pray to God, talk to a doctor. If the doctor says, I don't think you're going to make it, pray about it, and then it's okay to stop prolonging life. Briefly about Judaism and Catholicism, Catholic teachings. There's a very Catholic document that has beauty there that's appreciable by outsiders. It is Salvifici Dolores on redemptive suffering. The suffering can be a prayer offered up to God. They're quite severe that euthanasia is wrong. But then talk about church as a compass. They say if you've got questions, talk to your priest or someone well-trained in moral theology. And yet, they still say sometimes they don't provide benefit. You always got to do normal care, but you can refuse additional treatment. There's some resources they've got, much more than we have to do as Latter-day Saints. At Jewish end of life, the stereotype is that it's the endless casuistry of rabbis. That you get to these points where you can't stop the ventilator, but you can put it on a timer and not turn the timer back on. Or you can say, well, we'll leave you on the ventilator, but we won't replace the oxygen when it wears out. That's the stereotype. But you know, some authors writing in Israel say, yeah, that applies to some people. But the rabbis are actually pretty savvy medically. Even at the religious hospitals, there are variations in practice. And it's a highly decentralized system for deciding what can and can't happen. Now, I guess we don't have time really for this, but wanted to talk a little bit about whether official pronouncements and positions actually affect the approach to death.
Take a few minutes.
Okay. Yeah, what's interesting, this is from my cultural history book. Jacques Sarin is a 17th to 18th century Huguenot preacher who wrote a piece called Advantages of Revelation. The antebellum Christians in the newspaper circulated it as comparison between heathenism and Christianity. And the Mormons felt specifically reprinted. They were so cocky about the fact that they knew how to die and non-Christians didn't. Quote, their outward tranquility being only a concealment of trouble within. They're thinking of Socrates, right? He says he can die at peace, and you can't die at peace if you don't believe in Jesus. After all, if some pagans enjoyed a real tranquility at death, it was a groundless tranquility to which reason contributed nothing at all. And to be honest, I see that a lot when I talk to people about my research interests. Mormons, of course, die better than anybody else because we've got these great beliefs. What's interesting is there's a lot of literature, a lot of it pretty bad, some of it reasonably good, that suggests that the relationship between what's called religiosity and coping or decision-making at the end of life is highly variable. And in fact, people describe positive religious coping and negative religious coping. And in some patients, there's clearly a transition from positive to negative religious coping. Anybody have a guess what kind of social scientists mean by negative religious coping? It's yelling at God. Right? If you're not religious, you won't yell at God because you don't believe in God. So it's religious, but it's not positive religious. It's yelling at God. And it turns out that in survey material, as they get sicker, they tend to yell. Now, I moved from an area where the hospital I worked was in the middle of an Irish Catholic area. And so we treated a fair number of Irish Catholics. And I thought, well, you know, I'm coming back to Utah. We've got very distinctive beliefs about the end of life. And anticipated that I would be surprised by a brand new way of approaching end of life. Anecdotally, that means Samuel Brown's observations. Not really. I have not seen a substantial difference in how people approach this.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. We will. So I'm going to close on some practical advice. Recognize if you or a loved one is very sick that many physicians are as scared of dying as you are. And it takes some patience from everybody to figure out what the right thing is to do. There's going to be uncertainty. It's probably worth letting people that love you know in advance where you want to give up. Or not give up. Where you'd be done with letting the docs get in your way. I apologize. Freud, I'm sure, would be pleased with me for that. And the gospel provides a flexible spiritual context to seek alignment with God's will in the face of death. And it may also provide comfort and direction, even if atheists can die as gracefully as we can. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll be.
You can stand right here
if you
like.
All right. Stand. Which would you which is better for you?
It doesn't matter.
I got
it. It doesn't matter.
But I need this for their recording.
But you have to use the mic.
Yeah, I know. Okay, I'll be. I won't take more than 10 minutes. Max, you just cut me off. I go longer than 10. Just a simple question. If the doctor comes to you and says, look, you've got this condition, and it's very serious, and we can do 1, 2, or 3 to help get you well. No guarantees, but here are the percentages, and here's what would be involved. How many of you really want to be involved in making that decision between 1, 2, and 3? Come on, how many? How many don't? I knew you would say that, but you are a very unusual sample of the American public, and we know this from 40 years of studies. The vast, vast, vast majority of people just want the doctor to get them well, and that is usually defined as mental function, and they want to be able to feed themselves, dress themselves, go to the bathroom themselves, and they don't want to be involved in informed consent. It's just, you are unusual. So you gotta recognize that. You are an unusual. Most people don't. And that's true. I'm really fascinated by what Sam has said. Because I think what Sam is doing and pushing it even further represents the future of the intellectual engagement with Mormonism. Not the kind of cultural history.
15, maybe 20 years ago, Lester Bush published a book in a series, Ethical Issues in Mormonism, Medicine and Mormons. It was mostly historic. That's not the future. The future is taking our fundamental beliefs and seeing how they work out, both in the high philosophical and theological world, but also in these more practical and moral theological kinds of questions, and how we wrestle with these kinds of things. Does anybody know if the church issued a statement and what it said when the nation was going through the Terry Schiavo affair three years ago, I guess now. Does anybody know?
Not with the church.
What?
I've heard all about it, but not with the church, Dan.
Yeah, it seemed like you'd have Warren Hatch or somebody pipe up, but they never said there was
people. No, it was an official statement issued by Public Affairs. They really couldn't get away from it.
Okay.
But the statement said Mormons shouldn't involve themselves in the use of the nation thing, but for the rest of it, Mormons should not think that they need to prolong life by every means possible. End of story. Period. They actually issued an official statement, but it was okay, there are some things that are forbidden, but most people forbid active debate. You debate about physician assisted suicide, but it's still illegal everywhere in the United States, and only one state. Every time it gets on the ballot, it loses. And there are reasons for that. I don't know. But they issued a statement, but it basically said, make your own decision. The interesting thing is, one of the most fascinating visuals from the Terry Schiavo affair was, you saw this on CNN. Jesse Jackson standing here, and Randall Terry, standing right next to him, saying, we cannot kill Terry Schiavo. Jesse Jackson saying, the poor, the handicapped, are going to be the victims of this. Stop. And there's probably no more liberal political voice in America than Jesse Jackson. Randall Terry saying, no, life is sacred. This is murder. We got to stop. Nowhere to be seen was a Mormon spokesman. Now, the Catholics didn't like what was happening to Terry Schiavo. That's true. But that was a fascinating visual. Let me try and contrast Mormonism with particularly Catholicism, which I know of, because before I'm only a professor of philosophy, there's no ethics. Well, I teach ethics, but I'm not. There's no separate ethics part of my title. Before I came to Utah State, I was a professor of moral theology at Fordham University, a huge, big Jesuit university. We had a doctoral program. I was doing doctoral students, but New York's no place to train family and my professors. Take a case that Sam, the kind of case that Sam might do, very easy. Your grandmother, or in some cases, your mother, my case would be my mother. But for some of you, it's the grandmother. Your mother or grandmother is 94. She's in an ICU. She's had a stroke. Maybe other things, but what they know first is it's a stroke. So they take a few days, run some tests, see what's going on. Your mother's unconscious, or is not capable of making a decision for herself. And she didn't make her wishes known, which again is not unusual. The vast majority of patients in a situation like that, you say, okay, what did they want? Well, we think they would have wanted. Well, they probably would have wanted. Oh, we know they would have wanted. Okay, how do you know? Well, that's the kind of person they were. That's not evidence. That's your belief of what kind of person they were. In terms of writing it down, very few people actually write it down. And they write it down in such a vague way that it really isn't relevant to them. And now, okay, well, who do they want to make the decision? Well, I'm excited about that. But your mother or grandmother is 94. She's had a stroke. She's in an ICU. They've done the tests. It's taken 2 or 3 days to really get clear what kind of, would she ever come back to any kind of functional level of mental, cognitive health, anything? And when they say, okay, here are the facts, and she's not coming back, but we can keep her hooked up to the respirator for a few months, weeks, feeding tube, we can do that. And you go out and talk to the family. Now, if this family is kind of not knowing what to do, is in that emotional state where they just hard for them, and they go and talk to their priest, their Catholic, their priest will have tens of thousands of pages of rich, precise analysis. Rich, precise analysis of what to do. Just extremely detailed. And those of us who work in this field have to admire the precision, the detail, the rigor with which the Roman Catholic tradition has tried to balance mercy for people in this condition, but also the idea that life is sacred and shouldn't be just precise analysis. They just... Now, the upshot, the long and the short of that is the official Roman Catholicism would say that if your grandmother is on a respirator, you may, but you may take the respirator away. But if she's, and when I taught in medical school, before I got the department, I taught medical access in medical school, you'd see people who didn't need a respirator, but boy, they needed everything, and like a feeding tube. They needed artificial, like Terry Shiloh didn't need a respirator. You can't take feeding tube and artificial hydration of life. You just can't. It's morally wrong. It's forbidden by the Roman Catholic Church. And that's why they condemned Terry Shiloh for the Terry Shiloh affair. Judaism has the same rich, precise, thousands of pages of analysis. Mormon Church has none of that. None. And more, we don't have any inclination to develop it. Look, Apostle Nelson probably saw hundreds, if not thousands, of patients in those kinds of conditions. He shows no inclination of writing something like that. Samuels, BYU. But more importantly, since the early 1980s, they've had an organization of LDS physicians that's run through BYU. It's called Collegium or Collegium. They publish a magazine every year. They say, okay, here are experienced LDS physicians around the country. Haven't they been writing in, thinking through these issues? No, nothing. What the Mormon, this tells you something fundamental about Mormonism in these kinds of situations. Mormons say, here are some things that are forbidden, just a few. Get the best medical advice you can, and then don't talk to your priest, don't talk to your bishop, don't talk to your state president, don't write to the general authorities or the regional representative. Talk to the source of all moral wisdom. It's you and God. Get the medical advice, think it through, then take your idea of what you think should be done with your grandmother. Take it to God. And that's better than taking it to the general authorities, better than taking it to your bishop, because you're consulting the source of all moral wisdom. In those kinds of cases, Mormonism is a whole lot more flexible than Saint Catholicism, with which it is often linked on these kinds of issues. On 99% of the hot button issues of the day, the church says, well, make your own decision. Consult with God, obviously, but make your own decision. It's much more flexible than what you might find than in other religious traditions. So I think we ought, as Mormons who are interested in the world of ideas, be thinking through these issues, writing in these things, showing what the different alternatives are and what the moral implications of each are. And I think that's where we need to go. Thank you.
Very good.
If anyone has any questions,
No. We have it figured out. Okay, everybody. We're up to our question time now. Please just line up over here. Please be sure when you come up to ask your question, make it brief, make it to the point, and make it into the microphone so that the CD picks it up. Who's going to be first? Just come right on up, and we'll just make a little line of folks. Thank you. There's the mic right there.
Hi. I've been a pediatric nurse for the last 10 years. I've been nursing for 20, and I know we haven't addressing the end of life, but on the other scope, the premature babies, and I don't know if there's if you've had anything because that's always been a debate for me, is saving the micro preemies that are less than 24 weeks and how we're doing that. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts about approaching life and then because I have to care for these micro preemies later. So that was just my question.
Might as well just stay there.
That's a wonderfully rich area. As Dr. Sherlock has indicated, the LDS Church has not made any commentary there. And it's made more complex that the micropreemie sits next to the devastated child who was born at term but with profound disabilities. And I don't know that we have any clear guidance on it. And other traditions, in my knowledge, tend to say, push on. It is not impossible that in 30 years, for $3 million, we could get a 20-weeker to lead something resembling an IQ 90, pleasant, interactive kind of life. And when we reach that point is really not certain. And the complexity comes in getting there, right? We've been able to get from 28, 29 weeks to 24, maybe 23 and a half weeks. And we've done it by spending a couple of million dollars on an awful lot of children that 10 years ago would have been classified as miscarriages. Maybe stillbirths, but probably miscarriages. That's a very complicated area. I don't have a good answer. Things that play into it are the fear we have of discussions about abortion and women's control over their bodies. As you define a 21-weeker as a resuscitatable human, how does that play into policy debates about this charged issue? We have issues about pocketbooks. We got to pay. If our society wants that to happen, it costs money. And we got to decide that we're willing to do it.
Well, because I'd like to be,
Come up again, please. Come up again. We need to get everything on the CD. Stay there until you're done with
it. Okay. I just would like to have that choice. Because parents who have a 24-weeker, they don't have the choice to not let the child go because the doctors say we'll try to do everything, even though they're devastated, or even 23 weeks, and they're just barely hanging on, they spend millions of dollars. So I would like to be able to somehow say, okay, it's okay to let these children go. But I know that that's just impossible right now.
I think that's a sacred impulse for you to have, and I don't know that we have good direction about how to respond there. It's much easier ethically when they're devastated than when they're just too young to have been born.
But you can't even do it devastated.
Well, that's actually not. I'm not a neonatologist, but clearly in the United States there is. Clear precedent for withdrawal of care on newborns that are devastated.
Okay.
There's no doubt about that.
Whether you think it's right or wrong, one thing is a substantial majority of Mormon patients from physicians that I've talked to want to keep going to preserve a very fragile preemie or a very damaged newborn, if there's some chance that they can go on living. Okay, they're not willing to say, well, he's too handicapped. I don't want to care for a handicapped child. Most Mormon parents won't do that. Legally, just physicians don't have the option, legally, of withdrawing care. Parents don't, physicians don't, from a newborn that is very, very damaged and will survive. But but with a great deal of effort in them, survived in a very fragile and handicapped state. They just don't have legal. That was decided in the 1980s. I can tell you the story about that.
Okay, go ahead and sit down again.
I have a question for you, Sam. I'm a physician too, family practice doctor who sees this end of life stuff from a slightly different point of view. I very much enjoyed the presentation of both of you. What I'd like to do is try to bring Dr. Sherlock's challenge to your talk. What I heard you say was, I think you took pains to illustrate to us that terminal medical care isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And I think it's important that we as LDS patients learn that that death is inevitable and that we need to learn to accept it when it comes. I'd like to tie that idea to what Dr. Sherlock said, that the formula for LDS people is to get the best medical advice they can and make the decision on their own. I would like you to comment on whether the best medical advice is out there. In other words, are we as doctors so afraid of facing this, or so enamored with our own abilities to squeeze out a 2% chance of life, that we maybe fail to give that medical advice, which gives a proper perspective for making this decision?
My patients get good medical advice. It's rare, and it really, just so we're aware, as an ICU physician, I take a lot of extra time to think through and be with people in making the decisions about what makes sense and what doesn't. And my area of scientific interest is in these prognostic models. And it's an exhausting process for a physician. It's not really compensated by insurance companies. It's considered something you just would do if you're a good person. So it's a huge burden for physicians to bear at a time when they're under a million bureaucratic attacks. So your point is very well made, that it's possible if things are just moving through quickly that you're not going to get great medical advice. There are a few options. One is to, in a very calm way, tell the ICU physician, we're open to thinking through the different ways, and we just wonder if you could give us some clear information about prognosis and quality of life. And when it's not the don't you dare let them die that just sends the ICU physician into mode of I will do every heroic thing that's ever been invented to prolong life, if you're able to approach it in those terms, it can activate the ICU physicians to have that kind of input. And the other thing is that there are some backups. There are, in most larger hospitals, palliative care committees that are available for consultation about those specific issues. And you can say, if your sense is things just aren't going well for my loved one, and everybody looks a little bit dour and grim when they go into and out of that room, but they're uncomfortable talking to me straight about it, then you can say, hey, could we talk about a palliative care consultation? And when the palliative care comes along, they tend to emphasize not giving heroics. But you can say, I'm interested in heroics if they'll get a reasonable quality of life on the end. And having that extra voice there that's a professional, usually a nurse practitioner or a physician, able to give input back, I think allows you to get the better input back. You could even ask something as seemingly obtuse as, what's my dad's Apache score? Right? I mean, that'll at least force them to go calculate what the equations say and at least put you in a ballpark about what's going on. Those are some of the thoughts I have. But you're right. Part of the problem is not just that Americans have a history of denying the inevitability of death. Part of it is that our medical system is not set up to provide always highly useful information at that point.
Final thoughts? Just about okay. Okay, we have one, we have only about 3 minutes. Go ahead and ask your question real quick, and whoever you're asking it of will.
Okay, I won't.
We're merely out of time.
Anybody wants?
I think the church's position on abortion is
But I don't approve of abortion except in the case of rape or incest. And I didn't hear terms that they think that abortion equals murder. And yet it's okay to do it on babies that have been conceived by incest or rape. How can they have a mixed belief like that?
Actually, the church's position on abortion is not that of Roman Catholicism. Some may like, wish it were. It's not that of the National Right to Life Committee. It rejects the theory. The church's official position rejects the theory behind Roe and its progeny. Namely, that abortion is simply an individual choice of the woman. That's rejected. But in practice, if you tried to put the LDS Church's position into law, you would get the same number of abortions in the United States as you have today. No question about that. Because the church says abortion is acceptable for reasons of the mother's health and including mental health. Now, once you do that, the data from laws like that that were struck down in the companion case to Roe versus Wade, Doe versus Bolton from Georgia, once you have those kinds of laws, which were the reform laws of the 1960s, the data is clear. Under the health exception, you can get everything, you can get as many, there were more abortions in 1972 in the state of California, which with a law very much like what the Mormon Church whose policy is. More abortions in 1972, the last full year before Roe versus Wade, than there were in 1974, the first full year after Roe versus Wade. Data is absolutely clear. Once you have those health exceptions, and it includes mental health, it has to. But you've denied the theory. What you've said is this is a community decision because it involves life, but it's more flexible.
Thank you very much.
I know it is clear that when we have a doctor and a professor on the podium, there will be no shortage of comments, and we thank both of them for the really good presentation we've had. Thank you all very much. Remember, again, its CD will be available later on, and we hope you have a nice rest of your Sunstone Symposium.